No matter how the story ends, most literary works dwell on chaos, crisis, confusion, violence, or change. A few books are different, though. Utopian literary works focus on the alternative, the possibility of stability, equity, and balance provided by a rational social order. Utopia is an image of secular happiness. It might seem like visions of utopia would be appealing, and yet in the world of literature, visions of utopia are rare. Why is that? What does it say about us that our imagination prefers visions of chaos to dreams of order? Are we all dystopians at heart, or is it just that we think dystopia is somehow more realistic, more true to the human condition? I'm Alex Racy, and here with me to talk about this is John Farrell. Hey, John.
Alex, how are you?
I'm good. I'm glad to be back. We did that long series on art, and we were podcasting pretty regularly. And then we, I guess, gave ourselves a vacation. It wasn't planned, but now we're back.
These things happen.
It does happen. And the occasion, the thing that made us really want to start again, or made me want to start again, is that you were recently awarded a chair, the Waldo Nykirk Chair in Literature. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
Much deserved. I guess for people out there who don't know what academic chairs are, those are positions and titles that are awarded to professors of particular distinction. I think you are 100% deserving of that award. And when you received it, you were invited to give a public lecture, and you chose to give it on literature and utopia. And I love the lecture so much that I have talked you into talking about the subject here on the podcast. So thanks for doing that.
Thank you, and thank you for your kind words.
So here we are. Where do we start? I suppose you start because it was your lecture. Where is the place to start if we want to know what to make about utopia and dystopia?
Well, there have been various ways of thinking about utopia, which have been proposed over the years. But as I was saying, as you were saying, repeating my thesis from the lecture, utopia is a relatively minor literary genre. And when we see what seems to animate most literary works, it's really dwelling upon everything that utopia lacks. Like, utopia seems to leave out everything that makes literature interesting, which is conflict, difficulty, challenge, change, violence, pain, and so on. And so when I started thinking about this, one of the ideas that seemed most important to talk about is the fact that the first kind of utopian thinking that we can point to, I think, originated in ancient Greece, which is a culture which was really dominated at that time by a way of thinking that was produced through literature, right? And especially the Homeric poems. So the culture in which Plato and Aristotle and the various Hellenistic philosophers who imagined a rational life, they were doing so in contrast with the heroic code of Homer and the heroic epic and the heroic aristocratic culture that was the native culture of that area, and really is the foundational culture around the world of pre-modern living.
Right. I know it's been said that, you know, a way for us to conceive of how widespread that culture is to think of, you know, the Iliad is essentially the Bible back
yes.
then. It's where everybody gets their moral ideas,
yes.
their moral code, or at least sees the ideas that they believe in expressed in literature. And it's very much a, I guess, what we would call a warrior code.
It's a warrior culture. It's a culture that supremely values honor and respect and reputation because it's a very pessimistic culture, which doesn't think that human beings have any meaningful afterlife. Homer does show you spirits in the afterlife. They're merely just images, really. They have no real life. Achilles, the great warrior, when he's spoken to by Odysseus in the underworld, he tells Odysseus that it's better to be a slave breaking rocks in a field among the living than to be a king among the dead. There's no real value of life in that situation.
And it's this lack of an afterlife which leads people to think that they, if they're going to in any sense survive, it's by glorifying themselves in their mortal life, becoming a great hero
yes.
or a conqueror.
That's right. And of course, going along with this, it was a world of constant war and raiding and a world in which you needed to defend yourself. And the people who were able to defend everyone were the most admired and valued people in those cultures. So it wasn't a religious piece of whimsy that people wanted to be famous, but they wanted to distinguish themselves in the activity that everybody knew was the most important one for survival. And poetry plays a special role in this culture, because after all, the poet is the person who is able to preserve the news of the great people and the image of the warrior that everyone imitates. So, and poetry itself is a heroic activity. To make yourself famous by being a great poet, the greatest of the poets, memorializing the greatest of the heroes. So it's a very coherent set of conceptions around greatness, reputation, blood, family, and poetry. So that's the basic kind of literary culture, that the culture in which this literary dystopian aspect dominates.
And just to be clear, it's dystopian because the world it portrays is not one where we're all living together in peace and harmony. It's a world of conflict in which we're trying to outdo each other. And in that way, it's dystopian.
Yes. So that was the dystopian imagination as it existed and really provided everybody with their main way of thinking in the ancient world, in ancient Greece, and in so many other places. And it was within that culture that various Greek philosophers started a kind of reconsideration, launching a rational critique of human needs. And it was done by various people. Plato is the most obvious one to start with. And he actually engages in the exercise in the Republic of imagining a theoretical new realm, a new city, the beautiful city, where things are arranged according to reason, where appetite and our competitive instincts have their place, but they're very much subordinated in the grand scheme to mind. And then there are various other Hellenistic philosophers who take this way of thinking and develop it even further. And that, of course, is something that was a perennial possession of European culture. After that, it was integrating with Christianity in the Middle Ages and was part of the possession of Europe as it opened up to the New World in the later part of the 15th century and starting the 16th century. So when Thomas More, the inventor of Utopia, the famous work published in 1516, heard about the discovery of a new world and read about the voyages of Amerigo Vespucci, the man for whom America was named, he imagined this new literary game, really, which was to invent an imaginary society with a secular image of happiness, which would allow you to think about how life could be different.
For people who've never read it, do you think of Utopia as something like a novel? I mean, I think you and I had a conversation about this where I said, I remember reading it, but it's long ago, and it felt to me more like a political tract. I mean, it's written as a narrative, but it actually is just somebody spelling out their political ideas. But maybe I'm misremembering. Is it more of a novel and story than I'm remembering?
Well, it combines elements of dialogue, which, of course, is an old philosophical genre. The first book is really a conversation between this imaginary traveler who was supposed to have been with Vespucci on his voyages, and then went on to discover the island of Utopia. So Moore's speaker, his name is Raphael Hickladay. His name means peddler of nonsense. He describes this world that he's been to, and he also provides a critique of contemporary England. And the critique actually takes up the first book, the first half of Utopia. We know that it was written second. So Moore wrote the vision of Utopia first, and then he wrote the what we might call the application, which was the contrast between the way things should be and the way they are in contemporary England. And as I said in my lecture, the critique that he makes of his own, or Moore's own England, I should say, is very much the kind of thing that you hear from Democrats who are talking about America in the present. People like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. England is basically a conspiracy of the rich against the poor. People who do the important work get very little, and the people who are largely useless are making fantastic pots of money. And one of the interesting discussions that they have is, well, Moore and his friends say to Hitler, well, you should come to England then, and you should stay with us and become an advisor to the king. And Hitler says, you can't tell kings this stuff. Their life is robbing and making war. That's what they are. And if you decide to be the advisor to a person like that, you just become an accessory to his activities. So he has a very bold critique of the whole way of life that you see as the normal way of life in Europe at the time.
And by the way, so far you've framed this as a criticism that he could have made without Utopia, right? To just point to things in England and say, these are not working well. But the whole point of the description of Utopia is to show that things can be better, and this is how you could make them better.
That's right. And so now we have the scheme, which we've already been told is not going to help, right? We've already been told that...
Because you can't tell the kings.
No, you can't.
They won't listen.
You may know that Plato actually tried his scheme out. He went to Sicily to King Dionysus and became his advisor. He wound up being enslaved by Dionysus, and his friend had to buy him back. So he actually took a shot at doing what Hitler is too wise to attempt.
Right.
No, we also know that Thomas More...
Yeah, I was going to ask. We know that Thomas More made this mistake,
he
right?
He did, and he lost his head for it.
He did.
So, in Utopia, there's no inequality, and there's no private property. And this seems to be the key ingredient to most utopias, getting rid of private property, and therefore getting rid of competition, getting rid of all the extravagance and waste that's spent upon being better than other people by actually removing the things that people would use to compete. So there's no private property and there's no money. And there's a kind of uniform practical architecture that's used all across the island. It's an island about the size of England. And there's a kind of quasi-monastic aspect to it. People have meals in common. And there are lessons that are read and books that are read together. And really everyone's goal for life is learning. And so it really is, it's the life according to reason once more.
Well, and you can see where this comes from. It's not as though it seems like a vision that's very particular to Moore. I mean, probably all people at some point or other have had the thought, you know, if we could all just have a house that's good enough and we didn't have to buy a house that was better than other people's houses, why couldn't we just have that be the world and, you know, live together and get along and meet your neighbors and all that?
Yes.
There's a certain intuitiveness to what he's describing, right?
Of course. And I mean, in a sense, that's the key question, right? Since it would seem so easy to be happy, why are we compulsively driven to compete? That seems to be, that impulse seems to be the thing that keeps us from being rational in the way that philosophy would advise, right? So the key term, both in ancient thinking and in Moore, is living according to nature, right? A rational assessment of human needs, rather than living in as a fantasy in the minds of others, through fame, reputation, and so on. And using your leisure to learn, rather than to amass wealth. The reason I think this is a valuable angle to take on utopia is that in modern discussions of utopia, the contrast is almost always with capitalism, right? That's the key term. And of course, that makes sense, given that in our world, the standard model is capitalism, the standard model for the way the world is organized and so on. But to me, it's very interesting and revealing to remember that utopia comes to us as a contrast to this other heroic culture.
Right. Oh, I see. So right now we tend to think of utopia as different from what we've got, and what we've got is capitalism. So utopia competes with capitalism. But you're saying as we think about utopia as it begins to appear in literature, what Moore is fighting with is not so much capitalism, but this idea of honor culture that we have to get distant from. But what they have in common, right, is competitiveness.
Yes, exactly.
And so in that way, Moore's identification, at least in his own mind, of the cause of the problem, which is competitiveness, is the same as what people might say is the problem now. I mean, some people would say
yes.
It's the problem now. I see.
So it has that thing in common, that essential thing in common, that inequality, either heroic inequality, which is through families and through fighting and so on, or the accumulation of wealth and capitalism. Utopia is against those two things. So utopia is utterly unheroic, and it sounds actually crashingly boring. And when Hitler Day is finished with his narration, Moore says, well, I'm not going to try to argue with the guy, but obviously this takes all the glory and magnificence out of life. But of course, that's exactly the point, right? If you adopt the Greek philosophical kind of utopianism, which Moore is really playing with, then life is not magnificent. There's nothing grand about it. It's just living according to nature, having what you need.
Well, and can we dwell on this for a second? Because I take it that one of our big questions we're trying to face up to is, why are these utopias so unpopular as works of literature?
Yes.
And one thing you just mentioned is one of the possible explanations, which is that literature needs to be interesting, as obvious as that is to say. And human beings, for whatever reason, tend to be interested in conflict, right? I've forgotten which author said it, but we're not interested in reading a book called The Village of the Happy People.
No.
It's just not something you're intrigued by. So I take it one explanation of why we have so few utopias is just that as a literary subject, it's dull.
That's right.
But I take it that another possible explanation, and maybe this is something you're going to explore, is that it's sort of worse than dull. It's somehow untrue to reality or false or something like that.
Well, it's untrue to our psychology. And I guess my basic assumption is that the heroic idea has something ineliminable about it. We do fundamentally care about how other people view us. And we are motivated by a desire for respect. We seem to think that we want happiness, but our imagination is continuously drawn to dystopia.
Well, I think this is an intriguing question to ask even about Moore's utopia, which is it just boring because there's no conflict, right? So, you know, nobody's having a fight with anyone else and nobody's cheating on anyone else and nobody's, you know, struggling. Or is it bothersome for a different reason, which is that actually we're willing to read a book about utopia. Maybe we'd even be willing to read a boring book about utopia. But the problem is this is not a convincing utopia because, as you said, it seems to be grounded in the idea that human beings are not what they really are.
Yes.
Grounded in the idea that we could ever get past our competitiveness. So we'd be happy to read a book about a great utopia, but this just isn't one.
No, we can't imagine people being that good.
So is it too soon for me to ask you whether you think what we learn from reading these utopias, and I know we've only discussed one so far, but is what we learn something like all these utopian plans, the reason why they fail is that when people dream up utopias, they tend to dream them up in ways that are just not compatible with the basic nature of human beings? I mean, is that what we're learning essentially by reading these utopias and noticing our own lack of interest in them or resistance to them?
Yes, I'm trying to find a way of lining up the fact that literary utopias are tedious, that people can be deeply motivated by the notion of utopia to try to make a utopia, because we share the utopian's sense that the heroic and competitive life is truly irrational, right? I think everyone can share that, and you can see Moore makes a fine presentation of it.
So here's a question then. So suppose one of the things we might learn by reading utopian literature is that the utopias people tend to dream up, these ones with no competitiveness, are unrealistic. As appealing as they might be, and we understand why they're appealing, but they're unrealistic. So the question would be then, is there a piece of literature which gives a picture of a realistic utopia, right? So you've picked out one that you think teaches us what a utopia essentially can't be because it's not compatible with human nature. But are there books in the history of literature where you think that doesn't seem on its face to be as utopian, but in a way it's a better utopia because it's more compatible with human nature? I mean, I was thinking about this question because I wanted to ask you about it, but in a certain way, the endings of a lot of stories, now not the middle, but the ending,
right,
is kind of utopian,
sure,
right? So you have two human beings, and let's say it's a romance, and they can't get together through a series of misunderstandings and conflicts. And then what happens at the end of the story is that they get together and have a normal human romance. And although I don't normally think of it this way, I suppose you might say, well, the reason why that's appealing is that that is actually a realistic human utopia. You can fall in love with someone and get along with them, but you can't move to the island of utopia and live in communal housing. But maybe you have better examples. Are there?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I talked in my talk about my experience as a child of reading Dickens and suffering with his characters as they are persecuted by evil villains and so on, and in poverty especially, and loss of respect of every kind. And what an intense pleasure it was to suffer along with them in those circumstances. And then, of course, happiness does eventually always arrive in Dickens. But there's always a bit of disappointment to it, right? The real fun of the book is the suffering and difficulty, and authors have to be very careful not to let that final conversion to happiness cloy. It cloys so easily. You've got to whisk those people off the stage before you have to put up with too much of their happiness.
Now, so it sounds like, to some extent, you agree with me that the end of sort of conventional books and stories are utopias. But I guess one of the things I wanted to find out, since you have such bigger knowledge of literature than I do, is there anything in between that? Has anyone in literature ever tried to give what you might call a realistic utopia? So it's not just people managing to get together and get married and be a little bit happy together for a while. It's better than that, but it's not foolishly unrealistic.
That's a good question, and I have to think about that more than I can do on the air. I don't really know that anyone has tried to write a book that is both a revolutionary organization of life that is also realistic in its way of solving problems. Now, one thing that does come to mind is the novels of Ursula Le Guin. And she's a science fiction writer who imagines other worlds and what they're like. Her most famous book, perhaps, is The Dispossessed. And it's actually very interesting. It is a world without property, where competition has been tamped down to a large degree. And people are realistic. They're human beings with the usual foibles. And they do still slip into petty competition. But overall, there's a dullness in this world that is the fruit of the fact that the essential problem has been moderated to a large degree. And one of the things that provides a residual interest is that in both that book and in her other famous one, The Left Hand of Darkness, which has similar ambitions and qualities, nature is incredibly harsh. So there is a sense of constant struggle against this harsh and grudging planet. And that produces a kind of solidarity with among the people and a sense of limit that makes it more realistic and a little more interesting.
Right. You know, it's interesting that you thought of science fiction, because when I was trying to think of my own answer, and I don't know as much literature as you do, one of the first things I thought of was Star Trek. And here's a show which is supposed to be an optimistic vision of the human future. People do still have squabbles with each other, and they don't always get along, and they argue. But they all have this basic attitude that they're off to do something kind of grand, which is that they're explorers exploring the cosmos. So they can come into conflict with something, even something very serious, but it's like with Le Guin, it's something external to them. Another interesting thing about Star Trek, I mean, and I don't know that much about Star Trek, so I'm sure some listeners are going to write in and tell me I got this wrong, but but the in Star Trek, one way in which the bad side of human beings has been tamped down.
By the way, are we talking Star Trek 1, which is the one that I know, or the more recent Star Treks?
I think this is true in all of them, that okay. They have, from the very beginning of the show, they have a machine that just makes whatever you want. So nobody wants for anything, right? And there'd be no point, for example, in getting yourself a gold necklace, because there's just this machine you can go to and you can say, I think you can talk to it. You say gold necklace and it just makes you one.
Right.
So it's not so much that in the Star Trek world, people are better and don't feel the need for status, or at least that's never explicitly said. There's just a technological solution, which is that nobody needs anything anymore. And I think, I was thinking this through, I was realizing that I think a lot of genre fiction, maybe science fiction and fantasy in particular, has this characteristic. It's trying, or at least some of it is trying to pit humans against something other than humans, which is what normally happens in literature, right? So it's humans versus aliens, or humans versus cosmic catastrophes, or in fantasy, it's humans against, you know, dragons or something like that. And so the idea is to maintain your interest by still having conflict. But on the other hand, people are supposed to be, in at least vaguely realistic ways, better than they are here. So can we push a little bit, though, on this idea that we find this maybe a little bit in fantasy and science fiction? Because here's another thing I found intriguing about this. So, whether we ultimately all really in our hearts believe this or not, we're supposed to believe that the deep truths are found in the great works of what sometimes people call literary fiction, right?
Yes.
The serious stuff, which normally does not include fantasy and science fiction, which is looked on, rightly or wrongly, as kind of B-grade genre. But wouldn't it be strange if the best thinking about utopia had been done by the so-called B-grade authors? I mean, I was interested in your reaction as a person who studies the great works of literature. Not that you hate the science fiction or fantasy, but as somebody who does study principally the famous works of literary fiction, is it sort of shocking to find out that the most sensible portrayals of utopia have been done in Ursula Le Guin or in Star Trek?
Well, the trouble with Ursula Le Guin, to me, is she's still boring.
But that doesn't mean she didn't do a good utopia. That just means she didn't write a good book, right?
Right. But I think that Moore is more interesting because he makes you feel the inhuman quality of utopia and the problem of getting rid of all the grandeur and interest of life.
Well, I guess what you're after is the idea that even if Le Guin or whoever gives us a more realistic picture of utopia, that's not the same as giving us the picture from which we learn the most. Maybe we learn a ton by reading more and seeing the ways in which this utopia is not functional.
Thank you.